Leviticus is in the Old Testament, kind of at the beginning of your Bible there, about three books in. Leviticus chapter 16 will be our text tonight for Good Friday. Thank you, honey. Leviticus 16. If you don't have a Bible, there should be within reach. Please make sure you have one. Really want you guys just to see every verse here. We're going to be going through a ton of scripture. I just want you to be able to see the words and kind of what's going on here. Before I was a Christian, I used to speculate on various ways to have quote-unquote experiences with God and access to God. To my shame, through various endeavors, substances, and so on. And I find when I talk to a lot of people these days, people who are kind of, just checking out the whole Christ and Christianity thing, it's kind of the same deal. A lot of times people talk about, well, I had access to God this way, or I had an experience with God that way, and so on. And really, that's a question I find that often is characteristic of many people, no matter what their spiritual persuasion. An access to God or an experience with God. And really, the Bible teaches that access to God or an experience with God really has nothing to do with some kind of existential feeling. Really, it teaches something entirely different. And in the book of Genesis, which is the first book of the Bible, in chapter 3, this whole idea of access to God and having this free sort of line with God, really, the Bible says, was broken at the first sin of mankind. Man has forfeited his access to God. Man has forfeited and willfully denied any sort of experience with God because of his sin, and nothing has changed to this day. And we would expect access to God and an experience with God not to be something flippant. I mean, if you think about, if I wanted to have access with the president or President Obama or something like that, that's just not something that you just do in your own sort of on your own terms. Right? I mean, you don't just say, well, I'm going to just call Obama up and on my own terms, I'm going to have a meeting with him and do business with him. It doesn't work that way. Okay. You will meet with him on his terms, if at all. Right. And really the Bible teaches it's that whole idea, but even more so. And which would you expect for the God of the universe? And the point really is that access to God has been denied because of man's imperfection. Yes, because humanity is not perfect. We have forfeited to God. We can do nothing in and of ourselves, the Bible teaches, to please him, to experience him, to get at him. And it is all because we haven't sort of found the right method or we haven't developed a right technology. It is because fundamentally of man's fallen moral nature. And Christ had something to say about this. You hear this verse thrown around a lot. We'll go ahead and put it up here. John 14, 6. Go forward maybe one more there. Jesus said to him, I'm the way, the truth, and the life. No one comes to the Father but through me. The Father, it's the Christian name for God. It's just the idea. No one can come to God but through Christ. So access is limited here. That verse is tossed around flippantly. And what it means requires the book of Leviticus. And without the book of Leviticus, without even more what's happening in the book of Leviticus and what happened in those days before Christ, we can't properly answer that question. So I want us to go back in time tonight for a Good Friday study and walk through the elaborate process and ceremonies of how any human on the planet can have access to God. And be forgiven by God and be right with God. When I'm saying access or forgiven or be right with God, I'm using those things synonymously. And we're going to see a very elaborate ceremony. If you've been with us in our gospel community groups, we've been seeing this. From the time God's people come out of Egypt, okay, he rescues them first. Then he gives them the Ten Commandments in that order, which is an important order, by the way. And you read those we're looking at these Ten Commandments in Exodus 20. It's like, man, if you're honest with yourselves, okay, number one, love God above everything. just put him over everything? I mean, like, how many times a minute are we failing that? Are we loving God as much as he deserves? Right? So we see a problem there. And then after Exodus, God gives these sacrificial, ceremonial rites, R-I-T-E, for his people to say, okay, I know that, you know, because you've forfeited access to me and being right with me morally through your sin, and I'm showing you that through the Ten Commandments, boom, number one, you don't have to go much farther than that one. I will provide a way for you to be right with me, but it's going to be elaborate. And we can go to that. If we go to that first slide before John 14, do that, Matt, if you wouldn't mind. If God's people, if an Old Testament believer sinned, God gives an elaborate process by way of introduction here. There's many offerings. First, like for one sin. And in Leviticus 4, it says, even unintentionally. If a human sins, even if he doesn't mean it, this is what he has to do. First, a sin offering by offering an innocent animal, like the best animal of the flock, which acknowledges God's missing of the mark. That was the first thing you do. The second was a guilt offering, which impresses upon the believer this idea that, you know, sin is far from a small thing. It's breached the relationship between me and God. Third, there would be a peace offering. This is for one sin, which sort of recognizes the disharmony has been repaired. Okay, there's been a breach by that sin, and now it's been repaired. Leviticus chapter 3. And the peace offering you can give for three different reasons, and there's like different variations of offerings within the peace offering. A thank offering, a vow offering, and a free will offering. In addition to that. And then, number four, if any restitution needed to be made, you know, if you, you know, broke someone's chariot or whatever, that too. And God often said, like, restitution plus 20%. So, man, if you're a believer, you know, in the days before Christ, you're understanding how difficult it is, really, to live for God and to show how easy it is at the same time to sin. Commandment number one, love God more than anything, all the time. And forgiveness isn't a flippant thing. I mean, you would have been absolutely lined up at the temple to do these offerings all day. You would just have to live at the temple and please bring me a constant like pipeline of goats, and goats would go extinct in Israel just because of you, because of one person. As you can see, there's this like tension here. It's impossible to just keep in right relationship with God. So what was someone in the Old Testament days to do in order to be right with God, to maintain like a good relationship? Even the most like rigorous observance of all these things would still leave you with tons of unacknowledged sin. Nah, I failed today. You know, I got angry at my wife today. You know, I was thinking of something I should. I mean, just on and on and on. And so there would just be this guilt that would remain before God, and the result, God's people would just feel this lack of separation, which means a lack of joy with the most important being in the universe. And in God's huge love, he thinks of this and knows this and does something about it. He does two things. You know, for kind of like all this cleanup. Number one, he makes a provision to continue forgiveness in a relationship with him, even though it's impossible to give an offering every single time. Okay, but number two, he doesn't do so flippantly. Okay, and the way he did this was in Leviticus 16, this ceremony called the Day of Atonement. And in Hebrew, it's called Yom Kippur. Yom Kippur, the Day of Atonement. And this was such a massive day for believers. Okay, not just for Jews, but someone who like, man, I want to be right with God, like I'm going to come do this. It was such a massive day back in the day, they just called it the day. Like if you were a believer back in the day, if you believed in God and were going to heaven before the days of Christ, I mean, the day, that's all it was. Man, I can't wait for the day. That's what it was called. And it was the annual provision given for believers to sort of serve as this spiritual cleanup for all leftover sins of God's people. Because God is a just judge. I mean, it's one for one. He can't overlook anything anymore, you know, than one of our human judges can overlook a crime. If he does, man, that judge needs to go to jail too, right? So it was a special day, a ritual, you could say, that would really appease the wrath of God for all the sins of all the people for the past year that hadn't been dealt with by other sacrifices. So you can imagine, man, I mean, if you know Christ here and you love Christ here tonight, I mean, you can think, man, that would be a massive day. Like Good Friday and Easter, I mean, are priceless to you guys. So any Old Testament believer, man, is going to feel this tension in their life. Okay, I've failed God several times this week. Man, I've only been able to give one sacrifice for a slew of sins. He would have a healthy guilt on his conscience, a right guilt. You know, like this feeling of separation, like when you have a conflict with a close friend, you don't really mend it right. That it's like, ah, that uneasiness, that's what he would have. And the Day of Atonement, Yom Kippur, was given to deal with this. Okay, this was anything but like, you know, oh, doing my nice church duty so I can be moral and, you know, check off my religious box. It was anything but that. There's nothing like that in the Bible. It all has huge meaning, talking heaven and hell, that kind of significance. So the Day of Atonement was to assure the believer, yeah, it's cleaned up, it's covered to bring assurance, you are right with the Holy God. So a critical day for God's people and for God. So I want to walk through, I want to take a walk in history with us tonight and just go through every verse of this chapter and see, man, what was this like? The day. What was this like? And just kind of spectate here as we tell the story of the Day of Atonement. And the main idea of the main idea of the lesson and of the chapter tonight is this. We'll go ahead and put it up here. This is the main idea. Like, to have our sin forgiven is humanity's greatest need. However, though it's not anything you can hope to accomplish. The greatest need for humanity is not the cure for cancer. It's not to find a good, like, behavioral technique. It's to be right with God. But it is nothing that humanity can accomplish. Access to God, forgiveness from God is completely on God's terms, which we would expect if God is God, right? Several observations I want to make from the text about this forgiveness. Here we go. The first one is this. If getting right with God is attempted on our own terms, we will die. If we attempt to get right with God on our own terms, you will die. What do you mean you'll die? That's like weird. I'll show you here from the text. Verse 1. Now the Lord spoke to Moses after the death of the two sons of Aaron when they had approached the presence of the Lord and died. All right. Stop right there for a second. Go ahead and put Leviticus. What's he talking about when the two sons of Aaron died? I'll go ahead and put this up. You know, a few months or whatever before this process, God's showing the people how to get right with God. And Aaron's two sons, Aaron was the high priest, Nadab and Abihu, we can just read this. The sons of Aaron took their respective fire pans and after putting fire in them, placed incense on it and offered strange fire before the Lord, which he had not commanded them. So going through the ceremony for forgiveness and so on, Aaron's sons were the priests, like the leaders representing the people. And fire came out from the presence of the Lord and consumed them, and they died before the Lord. Then Moses said to Aaron, it's what the Lord spoke, saying, by those who come near me, I will be treated as holy. And before all the people, I will be honored. So Aaron kept silent. So this is what happened. God's showing here, like, okay, I mean, and whatever they did here, we don't know exactly their leaders. The whole idea was they took God casually. It was like, oh, God's cool with how, as long as I'm sincere, you know, I can worship God here in this place how I kind of want. And God's showing, like, no, there's a way to go about it, actually. Because I'm God and you're not. And so he says in verse 2, I'm going to speak to you how to do this. The Lord said to Moses, verse 2, tell your brother Aaron that he shall not enter at any time into the holy place inside the veil before the mercy seat, which is on the ark, or he will die. For I will appear in the cloud over the mercy seat. There's a way to approach me, God is saying, to get forgiveness. God says, some other way, and you, Aaron, as the high priest, the priest of priests, you will die. Why? Why die? Because of our sin nature. God cannot allow sin to remain in his presence. And the punishment for sin is death and eventual eternal separation, which makes sense for a holy God. And no, you will not likely die on the spot, as happened often in Old Testament days. However, if I were to spend my life trying to figure out how I can accomplish access to God, how I can achieve forgiveness to God, I'll spend my life in futility. And I will die trying, and I will never achieve it. It is not anything a human can achieve on their own. And this is really the point of the whole chapter, the whole book of Leviticus, the whole Bible actually, that God has to come and take care of our issue. God is the one who does it. God is the one who approaches us. So access to God and forgiveness from God, going to heaven, is completely on God's terms. Number one. Number two, access to God in this day was not just by any person. It was not just by any person. In other words, it couldn't just be whoever wanted to. Verse 2, once again, look what it says. Tell your brother Aaron. Speaking to Aaron, look over at verse 32 of chapter 16 real quick. Verse 32, he says, so he's talking to Aaron here, verse 32. Leviticus 16:32, he says, so the priest who is anointed and ordained to serve as priest in his father's place shall make atonement. Turn back to verse 2. Hey, so you see, it's not just anybody. It's not just, well, whoever wants to have a cool experience with God and go to heaven. That's not how it works. In this time, it was only the high priest. And the high priest, there is tons of priests at any given time back in the day. But the high priest was the priest of priests. There was one at any given time. He had to be from the tribe of Levi, the 12 tribes in Israel. He had to be a direct male descendant of Aaron. And he held the office for life initially. And this high priest position was so serious that during the time of his service, he was not permitted to defile himself by even taking part in a funeral. Like, he couldn't go to a funeral. In addition to that, it was so serious, this is the high priest only, that he couldn't even go to the funeral of his parents. If his parents died while he was in service as a high priest, he couldn't go to it. Okay, commitment and service to God for this particular position surpassed even family responsibilities. Well, I don't like that. Well, it's not a flippant thing, really, to get forgiveness from God and go to heaven. Also, the high priest in other parts of the Old Testament talks about, man, he had to be physically dialed in. He couldn't have like deformities. He couldn't be blind. He couldn't have any skin diseases. I mean, just on and on and on and on. These particular things. So back in this day, if you wanted access to God and forgiveness from God, you came to Israel as a nation. You did it this way. You saw God displayed there by the people, and they would be used to bring you in. That was how it worked. And even then, there was one person on earth at any given time who had direct access to God in this way, and it was the high priest. Not because he had achieved anything or because, you know, he got like the moral guy of the year award. It was just because he was born into the right family. He didn't do anything. He just happened to be in Aaron's line. But even the high priest, one guy on earth had that kind of access to God in one day a year. And even then, I mean, there's an extraordinary, this particular ceremony that we're going to read through here in a minute. And if he didn't follow it, he would die. We saw right there, verse 2, he will die. Well, what if you were someone who wanted access to God? You know, but you're someone really important, even an Israelite. Real quick here, I want to show you an example. This is several hundred years later. One of the Israelite kings thought he could do it. This is talking about King Uzziah. When he became strong, his heart was so proud that he acted corruptly. What does that mean? He was unfaithful to the Lord his God, for he entered the temple of the Lord to burn incense on the altar of incense. He thought, well, I can have this experience with God. I mean, I'm a king, right? Then Azariah, the priest, entered after him, and with him 80 priests. 80 people come barging in after this guy, valiant men. They opposed Uzziah the king and said, it's not for you, Uzziah, to burn incense to the Lord, but for the priests, the sons of Aaron, who are consecrated to burn incense. It's got to be the right guy. Get out of the sanctuary if you've been unfaithful. You'll have no honor. Next slide. So what happens? But Uzziah doesn't listen to him with a censer in hand for burning incense, was enraged. And while he was enraged, the priest, the leprosy broke out on his forehead before the priest in the house of the Lord before the altar of incense. The chief priest and all the priests looked at him, and behold, he was leprous on his forehead. They hurried him out of there, and he himself also hastened to get out because the Lord had smitten him. And Uzziah was a leper to the day of his death. I mean, Uzziah was the king of Israel. The Lord is saying, nah, it ain't just anybody. It's going to be my way, God says. Access to God wasn't just any person. Third, it was just not just any place. You can't just have this experience with God and you know, get forgiveness and access to God at any place. Verse 2, look what it says here. Once again, he shall not enter any time into the holy place inside the veil. Okay, and this is a particular part in the temple. I'm going to put a bunch of pictures up here into the temple so you can see. Just real quick, this is like the whole court area, okay? And then the actual temple is this sort of building area on the left side there. And there's two separate rooms inside that. Okay, there's like a back room on the far left there. And it was separated by the veil. And then a larger room on the right. Okay, and that large room on the right, go to the next slide. I need like a pointer or something. It's fine. So you can see that purple sort of that purple veil separated what right here on the right was called the holy place. This place on the right is called the holy place. You can see like the menorah there and stuff. And then on the left was the most holy place, or the holy of holies. So there's a particular place God sets up if you're going to meet him and have forgiveness from him and know him. Okay, and the most holy place on the left there, that was the place in these days where the presence of God was like shown, was manifest. And it was inside the veil. And he says he must not enter this holy place before the mercy seat. What's the mercy seat? Well, the mercy seat, if your text says in verse 2, it's actually better translated from the Hebrew, the place of atonement, or the place of reconciliation. Once again, it was named that because it was where God manifests himself for the purpose of reconciliation. And this next slide is, this was this mercy seat. And what it was is, it was the ark. Okay, it's this box, like about 4 feet or so, a couple feet tall, gold all around it. And it had the Ten Commandments that God wrote on the stone tablets. Aaron's rod, the miraculously budded, like almonds, all the kinds of stuff inside of it. And then there's two angels or cherubim on either side, and the presence of God dwelt in the supernatural light there. Like it was like that. And that was the presence of God, and it was on that left side inside the temple called the most holy place, or the holy of holies. And that was the place where you met God back in the day. That's where his presence would remain. It wasn't just, well, I want to go to this vortex in Sedona where they stack rocks in a pyramid. It wasn't like that. Sorry, God ain't there, no matter how you feel. It was a particular place. Oh, what about Stonehenge or the pyramids? No. Fourth, access to God was not just at any time. It was not just at any time. Look again at verse 2. Tell your brother Aaron, he shall not enter at any time. In other words, it doesn't mean he shall never enter. It means he cannot arbitrarily enter. He can't just say, wake up one morning and say, well, I mean, I feel like going to the presence of God. God's like, no, not even the high priest. One day. One day. If he didn't, look what it says down to verse 2. Or he will die. He will die. If it's not Yom Kippur, he'll die. If it's not the high priest, he'll die. The only time the most holy place God's presence could be entered into was one day a year by one person, the high priest, in one place, this temple, by one method. And I'm going to show you what it is right here. Fifth, access to God was not just by any method. It wasn't just someone's opinion. Well, that's what you believe about God. No, this is God, capital G, absolute. It was one method back in the day. Okay, and we're going to blast through the verses here. Getting forgiveness from God was completely on God's terms, or it was not at all. And nothing has changed about God in principle. It is God's terms or not at all. The details of the ceremony are immense. We're not going to get into every little thing. But here we go. Verse 3. Aaron shall enter into the holy place with this. With this. In other words, there's no way he's coming in empty-handed. Yeah, he's the high priest, but he's not going to just waltz in there. Right? He has to be prepared. With what? With a bull for sin offering and a ram for burnt offering. So innocent blood given for his. Blood had to be shed before he even steps in. So he's presentable. Verse 4, he shall put on the holy linen, the tunic, the lined undergarments shall be next to his body. He shall be girded with a linen sash, attire, turban. He shall bathe his body, and so on. I mean, so there's all this very special garb that God says he needs to put on after having bathed. And now we're starting to get somewhere with the blood. Verse 5, he shall take from the congregation of the sons of Israel, in other words, from the nation, from the people, two male goats for a sin offering and one ram for a burnt offering. Then Aaron shall offer the bull for the sin offering, which is for himself, that he may make atonement for himself or for his household. Okay, the word atonement, a critical word, one of the most important words to know as a human being. It has the idea of reconciliation with God. And it means it's the whole picture of the life of an innocent sacrifice given for someone who is imperfect. Bringing back the relationship through shed blood. So notice, just for the high priest to go before the presence of God on this one day and perform the ceremony for other believers, he has to prepare himself by sacrificing a goat, a bull. Then he can go and do the ceremony for other people. I mean, even though the high priest would be the godliest dude in the nation, he can't even do the ceremony without first shedding blood for himself and then stepping in. It keeps going. Verse 7. He shall take the two goats and present them before the Lord at the doorway of the tent of the meeting. Aaron shall cast lots for the two goats, one for the Lord and one for the other, for the scapegoat. Then Aaron shall offer the goat on which the lot for the Lord fell and make it a sin offering. More blood offerings. Again, an innocent animal given for the people who had failed God's commandments. We'll come back to what's the scapegoat. Verse 10, we'll get back to that in a second. Verse 11. Then Aaron shall offer the bull of the sin offering, which is for himself. Notice how many times God is saying, for himself, for himself. Look what he says, three times in verse 11, which is for himself, to make atonement for himself and for his household. He shall slaughter the bull of the sin offering, which is for himself. What do you think God's trying to say? Yeah, even though you're the high priest, you still ain't perfect. You need an offering too. Blood spilling everywhere. Because sin, like not being perfect in other words, costs something. At least before the real and true and only God of the universe. Now here's where it gets more hectic. And by the way, what we're about to read is the first time he's still in the holy place on the right side. Here God's going to tell him, okay, now here's how you enter into the ark with the Shekinah light, the presence of God. Here's how you come into the most holy place. Verse 12. He shall take a fire pan full of coals, so this big like container full of burning coals, from the altar before the Lord and two handfuls of finely ground sweet incense. And bring it inside the veil. He shall put the incense on the fire before the Lord, that the cloud of the incense may cover the mercy seat, the ark there, in other words, that is on the ark of the testimony. Otherwise, he will die. Like, God, you've been telling me this. God says, I don't want you to forget. So he brings these hot coals where the presence of God was, and he brings two handfuls of this ground incense, places it in the fire on the hot coals, so that this thick cloud of sweet smelling incense. You remember, if you burn like a stick of incense, you get a nice little, like, I mean, he would throw a whole just bucket of it on there, and this huge cloud would just burn for a really long time, and the sweet smell would rise up, and the smoke would shield that supernatural light that would be above the ark, would shield like the presence of God from imperfect man, and protect, it would protect the high priest that would come in there. So, end of verse 13, he wouldn't die. And so it would keep the high priest, the sinner, from looking at the holy God. And if he did not, he would die. And so naturally, inside, like through the veil, into the most holy place, there was concern, great concern about the high priest's survival. As well there should be. I mean, you don't just go into the presence of God like you're speaking to one of your bros or something. Right? I mean, the high priest didn't just like waltz in to this long all-day process, you know, with his iPod blasting and just whistling and kind of skipping with his shoes untied. I mean, this was like, if this is making you uncomfortable, if like you're not a Christian tonight and this is the first time you've been hearing this, and it makes me uncomfortable too. I mean, he would come in sweating, nervous, shaking. Dudes died during this all the time if they were casual about God. If they're living a hypocritical life, like pretending like they're godly on one end, but they don't really love God, unconfessed sin. One Orthodox Jewish rabbi I was reading, he said this. He said, the slightest deviation could cost the high priest his life. Many high priests died during the Yom Kippur service. This is to Orthodox Jewish rabbi. Now, once he's in there, verse 14, look what it says. He shall take some of the blood of the bull, sprinkle it with his finger on the mercy seat, on the east side, also in front of the mercy seat. He shall sprinkle with blood, the blood of his finger, seven times. So in the most holy place, he takes a cup of the bull's blood, which he had already slaughtered outside in the holy place, and he just showers it all over the ark. While the incense cloud is just this whole scene of smoke coming up, all around in the presence of God, because it takes blood to make someone who isn't perfect presentable before God. He had to carry blood with him before God. Without the shedding of blood, no human can be forgiven. And so at this point, I mean in the day, in Yom Kippur, at this point, he is only acceptable to begin the ceremony for the people because he's just dealt with himself. The nation isn't yet taken care of. All the other believers haven't been dealt with yet. Verse 15, and here we go. Then he shall slaughter the goat of the sin offering, which is for the people. Okay, in other words, anyone who believed in God back then and wanted to be right with God, bring its blood inside the veil and do with its blood as he did with the blood of the bull and sprinkle it on the mercy seat, in front of the mercy seat. Okay, same thing. Showers the presence of God all over, but this time the offering for the people. Verse 16, he shall make atonement for the holy place because of the impurities of the sons of Israel, because of the transgressions in regard to all their sins. And thus he shall do for the tent of the meeting, which abides with them in the midst of their impurities. Impurities, transgressions, sin, impurities. What are you trying to say, God? Now, not only for the people did reconciliation need to be made, but check this out. But for the holy place, like for the stuff, for the tabernacle and for the altar and everything that was in there outside, it had to be covered with blood too. Why? Why would things have atonement made for? Well, it has nothing to do with the stuff, but because it had been associated with people. Often you will hear like well-meaning people say, you know, we should bless this place and pray over it, this house, this building, this business, to sanctify it and to make it holy. You know, or this thing is more holy than that thing. But here's the thing. The problem is not with the place or the stuff or demons hiding in a corner or whatever. No, the problem is that humans who are sinful use the stuff and dwell in that place or business or use that thing or whatever. That's the problem. That's what God is saying here. Do you see that from the text? If anything, instead of praying over a building or a place, pray a prayer of repentance and forgiveness for yourself. If you want to bless a place, or we want God's blessing on this building or whatever, have the people who inhabit that building or who do whatever they do in that place pray a prayer of confession to God and repentance, asking His forgiveness. Then that place will be blessed. Why? Because there will be humbled people who have repented of their sin. Because sin, unconfessed sin, is the thing that like makes things unholy, and only people have that issue. Okay, so even the stuff, verse 17, keeps going. When he goes in to make atonement in the holy place, no one shall be in the tent of the meeting until he comes out, that he may make atonement for himself and for his household and for all the assembly of Israel. Notice, he says, no one can be in the area. No one can be in the temple. I mean, there is a distance between the presence of God and the entire nation. And so the high priest wasn't the only one who was like, the only one who was shaken and nervous during this time, right? Because the people outside, the whole nation would be surrounding that whole court, the whole temple area that we just saw. I mean, sweating too, hoping the high priest had been living a godly life. I mean, if he had sinned against people, he had like asked their forgiveness. I mean, if he was struggling with his wife, he had owned up to it. If someone had confronted him, he wasn't defensive, he dealt with it. The people were just like, man, I hope he is not living a hypocritical life. Because they could do nothing but sit in the nosebleed section, as it were, around the temple and hope this critical ceremony could be successfully performed on their behalf so that they could be forgiven. It would be like watching your favorite football team, you know, in the national championship on TV, like 2,000 miles away. And you hope things go well. You're just nervous. You can't do anything but yell at the TV. It does no good. Shortens your life, maybe. Wakes up your neighbors. And you're just nervous. And there's a great distance from you, between you and actually having any type of effect on what's going on. Right? You just hope things go well. The illustration is crude, obviously, comparing sports to God, but you get the idea. There's nothing the nation could do. They just hope it goes well. Now, verse 20, look what it says. When he finishes atoning for the holy place and the tent of the meeting and the altar, he shall offer the live goat. Then Aaron shall lay both of his hands on the head of the live goat, confess over it all the iniquities of the sons of Israel and all their transgressions in regard to all their sins, lay his hand on the head of the goat, send it away into the wilderness by the hand of a man who stands in readiness. The goat shall bear on itself all their iniquities to a solitary land, and he shall release the goat into the wilderness. So this is what's going on here. There was two goats, right? We saw the one he killed already, but they served for one, was one sacrifice. It's like two part that took two goats to do this one thing. The slaughtered one paid the penalty of man's sin. But the scapegoat is what this thing is, as we saw back in verse 10, would be sent away and symbolized, okay, a death has been died, now our sin is sent away forever. And Aaron would, I mean, who knows how long this would take? Okay, confess all the sin of the nation, okay. I mean, how long does that take? Okay, so-and-so didn't love God at, you know, 2:31 p.m. on, you know, January 12th. So-and-so didn't love God at January, you know, I mean, how long does that take? Whatever sin had not been covered by other sacrifices, for that year only, they were sent away by the scapegoat. And sometimes one of the rabbinical records is saying that they would be worried that the goat, I guess, would come back sometimes. And so what they would do was they would go outside Jerusalem and push it off a cliff. They wouldn't kill it, okay? Because they already did that. They would just, you know, send it away, like go on there, Billy Goat or whatever. And that's how they would make sure it wouldn't come back, to symbolize sins forever being sent away. Verse 23, it continues. Then Aaron shall come into the tent of the meeting, take off the linen garments which he put on when he went to the holy place, shall leave them there. He shall bathe his body of water in the holy place, put on his clothes, So there was special garb that was strictly reserved for being in the presence of God that could not be worn in another place. So he'd have to take that off, wash, more cleansings. In verse 25, he shall offer up and smoke the fat of the sin offering. Any part of the animal that's left over, burn it. Deal with it. Verse 26, the one who released the scapegoat shall wash his clothes too. Because he was associated with this goat that symbolically had the presence of the, that had the people's sin on it. So that guy's got to wash too. He's not right. He's been in the presence of this thing that was supposed to send sin away. Okay, so he washes with water, verse 26, and afterwards he comes into the camp. Verse 27, with the bull of the sin offering and the goat of the sin offering, whose blood was brought in to make atonement in the holy place, shall be taken outside the camp, and they shall burn their hides, their flesh, their refuse in the fire. Then the one who burns them shall wash his clothes and bathe the body with water, then afterward shall come into the camp. I mean, and on and on and on it goes. Year after year after year after year after year, Jewish records think there was about 83 high priests from Aaron down to 70 AD, which is when the Jewish temple was flattened to the ground and there has never been another one built for a reason, which we'll see here in a few minutes. On top, this was the Yom Kippur on top of the daily sacrifices, those four sacrifices we saw, you know, the sin, the peace, the guilt, and so on and so on. This was on top of all that. For anyone, any random believer who failed God in any way, to fail to love God perfectly. So access to God is in God's way. It is God's way or it's no way. Now, sixth, the results of access to God, properly doing this, supposedly the high priest lives through this. And some of you have heard the theory of like, well, sometimes he would tie a rope. They would tie a rope around the high priest and have a bell in case he does drop dead and fall in the temple, they could pull him out. That's actually probably a myth. That's probably not true. But even so, I mean, they're always fearing for his life. Okay, just on and on it went. If he does it right, look what verse 29 says. This shall be a permanent statute for you in the 7th month, on the 10th day of the month. You shall humble your souls, not do any work, whether the native or the alien who sojourns with you. Four, explanation for the event. In other words, verse 30. It is on this day that atonement or reconciliation shall be made for you to cleanse you. You will be clean from all your sins before the Lord. Having sin wiped away is your guys' greatest need today, just like it was to people back in the Old Testament, and it's mine too. Nothing has changed. And it is nothing that any human can accomplish. Our greatest need is nothing we can accomplish. So if getting forgiveness from God and a relationship with God was completely on God terms, or is not at all, and nothing has changed, what do we do now? We don't have a temple. Okay, we don't have Aaronic priests. Can you imagine having to do these things? Why don't we do this anymore? What's going on? Hebrews chapter 9. Put it up here. Read this kind of slowly. There's a lot going on here. Thus, it was necessary for the copies of the heavenly things to be purified with these rites. What are you saying here? Stop right there. The copies of the heavenly things is everything in the temple, the bull, the ark. These are like pointing towards the reality of the infinite God who dwells in unapproachable light in heaven. These are copies of those. It was necessary for the copies of those things to be purified by these rites, by everything we just read. But the heavenly things themselves with better sacrifices than these. What do you mean better sacrifices? For Christ has entered not into the holy place made with hands, not into like a tent, which are copies of the true things, but into heaven itself. Now to appear in the presence of God on our behalf. Nor was it to offer himself repeatedly. As the high priest enters the holy places year after year, how does he enter? With blood, not his own. For then he would have to suffer repeatedly since the foundation of the world. In other words, if Christ were to do this, and he wasn't qualified, and he wasn't sinless, and he wasn't the Savior, and he wasn't God, he would have to do the same thing. He'd be in no better place than the high priest. But as it is, he has appeared once for all at the end of the ages to put away sin by the sacrifice of himself. And this is what we celebrate on Good Friday. Jesus Christ fulfills all of this. All of the Yom Kippur ceremonies and details. All of the sacrifices in every detail, and not in a yearly ceremony, but in one act of dying on the cross, which is what we celebrate today. Christ is the greater everything here. The old high priest had to offer sacrifice for his sins. Christ was sinless himself. He had to give no sacrifice for himself. The old high priest had to ceremonially wash himself to symbolize washing of sin. Christ needed no washing. He never sinned. He always loved God perfectly. He always obeyed the commands. Before, in the olden days, the goat was sent out of the temple outside the camp to send away sin. But Christ was sent away outside the temple and outside the holy city. He was crucified on a lonely hill called Golgotha, where he was nailed to a cross, the sinless offering once and for all. And he's forever sent away sin through his one death. Before, this thick veil shielded the most holy place and reminded people that there's a distance, plus all the people are outside. Christ, the moment he died, this veil in the temple split miraculously in half. Access granted now. Before, one person per year went before God, but Christ went once for all who would forever ask him for forgiveness and bow the knee to him. Before, people waited outside from a distance, hoping a godly priest could deal with their sin. But now, there is no waiting from a distance. There is no waiting for a distance. There is no hoping in a high priest with exemplary qualifications. There's no blood of goats needed to be sprinkled on a box and incense given and enter the right way with clothes and blood and water and blood and so on. There is no holy week. There is no holy day. No, forever who comes and believes on Jesus Christ, they are counted holy by his one act of dying on the cross. All under Jesus Christ need not fear or be anxious like the holy priest and like the people outside the temple hoping from a distance that their sins would be dealt with. No, you do not need to fear God. Will this make me right? Please, friend, do not think that anything you do can make you right with God. We're talking about God here. Nothing we can do. His standard of holiness is astronomical. The priest approached God for us. One guy on the planet, one guy per year. Now, Christ, end of the verse there, has put away sin by the sacrifice of himself. Before, you had to have a priest kind of go and like do your access to God and do, hopefully he can help me maintain my relationship with God and help me have a closeness to God so that I can ask God's forgiveness and go to heaven and maintain a relationship. No. No, no, no. Now God will answer any and all cries for whoever asks, because his son who cried from the cross was not answered because he had to die alone for sin as our sacrifice. You cry out, access granted. Jesus cried out from the cross, access denied, so that you could have access granted. He suffered for our sin. Leviticus, really, this is helpful to help us avoid the mistake of thinking that Jesus is like a cosmic homeboy or a nice moral prophet. God's like some, it helps clear up the misconception that God's like a cuddly grandpa who, you know, is too goofy and funny to care about sin and things like that. It helps us clear that up, doesn't it? When Christ ascended into heaven, okay, look at verse 24. Christ has entered not into a veil with a building in Jerusalem. He entered not into the holy place made with hands, which are copies, but into heaven itself. The heavens itself. What does that mean? It means after Christ died, he was resurrected, and then he went up in heaven. He He ascended back into heaven. Hundreds of people saw him do it. And there's no grave in Israel. And now today Christ stands in heaven in the presence of God, always standing in the holy place, without blood, without incense, because he offered his own and stands there to answer prayers and to intercede for all who will come who wants to go to heaven. He stands in heaven all the time because he alone is qualified for you and any human being on earth. He says, I died outside the tabernacle so that all who believe on me can come have direct access to God and forgiveness on faith alone. So, John 14:6, let's put it back up here one more time. Jesus said, I am the way, the truth, and the life. No one comes to the Father but through me. We understand a little bit more what that means now, don't we? That verse is a little bit more significant. I am the way and the truth and the life. No one comes to the Father but through me. But everyone who comes through him, immediate access. No special food, no special clothing, no special blood, no special nothing. Well, I got to get my life cleaned right. No, it doesn't say that. You just got to come, that's all. Well, I got to be like moral first. You're never going to do that, my friend. You're never, ever, ever going to do that. Jesus Christ was the perfect high priest for you. Access granted. Forever, without hindrance. Not based on your feeling or any type of experience, but on the work, the finished work of Jesus Christ on the cross. Well, I don't feel that, you know, I don't feel that I can just believe. Good thing objective truth isn't, and closeness to God isn't dependent on your feeling, my friend. It's dependent upon the work of Jesus Christ. Well, what kind of a practical result does this have? I don't think there's anything more practical than we as humanity who are condemned from a holy God in our sin. There's nothing more practical than having eternal, unhindered access to the God of heaven. Wherever, whenever. Remember the whole thing we said, it's through a place, through a time. All of that's gone now. The place, the time, the person you meet God is Jesus Christ. There is no place where you feel, experience, encounter God more. It is Jesus. And so you can rest now. Anyone in here who hasn't been perfect, which is all of us, you can rest through faith in Christ as your high priest. No guilty sentence. And if someone or Satan brings accusations in your past and brings up the archives of your sinful life, you don't have to play plug my ears game. You don't have to do that. No, you don't have to be like, well, I'm going to ignore all that and I'm just not going to think about the sin that I once was in. No, you can say, indeed, those sins I have committed and billions more. I sure have. I have been imperfect every day of my life. Your list falls pathetically short. However, I have a great spotless lamb, a high priest, who was sent away from the temple and forever took away all my sins. Keep the list coming. I have a high priest whose blood flowed that day. I have a great high priest who washed my conscience clean, who entered the veil and it slashed in half. Access granted through Jesus Christ. I have a vastly greater mediator than any priest or any human being who has not entered into a tent, but who stands in heaven, my friend. That can't be said about any religious or spiritual or any type of person, but Jesus Christ. He stands in the holy place by his own work. The old hymn says, well may the accuser roar of sins that I have done. I know them all and thousands more, but Jehovah knoweth none. So then, is that like a license for to live however you want? Is that what you're saying, Eric? No, man, it's a launch pad for worship. It's a launch pad for worship. And so appropriately, as it's Good Friday, we're going to celebrate that now through communion. Keep your Bibles open really quick, though. I want to show you guys something from Leviticus 16 still. Look back at verse 29. At the end of the verse, it says, on the 10th day of the month, you shall humble your souls. You shall humble your souls. Why does he say that? Verse 31, it's to be a Sabbath of solemn rest for you, that you may humble your souls. The ESV says afflict. The Hebrew word has the idea of to be lowered in submission, to be convicted of sin, to be aware that I have fallen short, to be broken. Not as a form of doing penance, but as a form of doing worship. Sitting around and being convicted of sin and doing nothing and being broken over our sin is one of the highest forms any human being can worship God. The Bible even talks about in places like Isaiah 66 and Psalm 51, where God says, man, I'd much rather you just like take a little time in your life every once in a while, sit, be convicted over sin, be humble, be broken that you sin, than try to like, you know, do good, be a moral citizen, join the nonprofit, do here, go here. He says, I'd rather you just sit and be convicted over your sin. That's one of the highest forms of worship. And that's what we're going to do now, just for a minute or two. As we remember with the bread and the cup, the body that was given outside the city, our great high priest, the scapegoat, whose blood was shed. No magic exists in the bread and the cup. Okay, these are just symbols. Just like all the symbols in the tabernacle, this is a symbol. The bread symbolizes his body that was given. The cup symbolizes his blood that was shed. Okay, ingesting some like grape drink and taking in some bread isn't going to do anything for you. It's about your heart, your conscience before God. Man, I want to encourage you, if you're kind of checking out this Christ thing and it's like, wow, there's a lot of blood and stuff, I'm stoked you're here. God is asking you, he's calling you, man, to get right with him, to believe on Jesus Christ. There is no access to God and no forgiveness apart from him. But with him, there is great full access and forgiveness. Friend, a death had to be died. Communion, this isn't a time to think about trying harder to be gooder. Okay, I'm going to, tomorrow's Monday, a fresh start, I'm going to be more moral. My friend, you can't do that. You can't do that without blood being shed. So God says just now, just sit, admit that you've fallen short of God, but that Jesus has died for it, and you can believe on him. Maybe this is the first night. Maybe this is the first night ever that this will happen for you. You can just believe on God. You don't need a high priest. He is the high priest. You can be saved and be going to heaven tonight simply by believing. It is a free gift. It's not free for Christ, but it is for us. Maybe some of you grew up in church or whatever, heard the stories, went to Sunday school, prayed a prayer as a child, went to camp. Someone told you you're a Christian, told you never to doubt it. But like these things that we're talking about tonight, I mean, this is like new for you. And this is like kind of a lot. And you thought you're a Christian because dad told you or whatever, but you've never heard this. Friend, you can believe on Christ too. Humble your soul, as the text says there. It's good news. Allow God to work on your heart. Your greatest need is not morality, but a Savior. So I'm going to give us a little bit of time. Let's go ahead and just talk to God, man. He loves you so much. God is passionate about you. Otherwise, he wouldn't have given his son. And when you are ready, please, not before, but when you are ready, come take of the bread and the cup. And please, friends, one more reminder. Do not take in an unworthy manner. 1 Corinthians 11 talks about that. If you're like, well, I don't want to like look weird and I want people to think I'm moral or whatever, just watch and see how this plays out. Okay? But man, you can just believe on Christ, and when you're ready, you can come up.